In his January State of the Union message, President Carter announced that he would ask Congress to approve a budget allocation to register young men for the draft. He subsequently announced he would ask Congress for the authority to register young women as well. Shortly after that, our Speaker, Dr. Daniel Ellsberg, addressed an anti-draft rally at the University of California at Berkeley. He urged the crowd of 3,000 to refuse to register for the draft. His anti-draft stance is based on his belief that the president's policy makes nuclear war initiated by the United States more possible. Our speaker received his Bachelor of Arts in Economics, summa cum laude, from Harvard in 1952. He subsequently attended Cambridge as a Woodrow Wilson Fellow. He returned to Harvard, where he earned his master's degree in 1953 and his PhD in 1964. Our speaker spent 5 years with the RAND Corporation in Santa Barbara prior to a long and involved career in Washington, D.C. In Washington, his posts included serving as consultant, strategic nuclear war planning and nuclear command and control office of the Secretary of Defense, serving on task forces during the Cuban Missile Crisis, and especially important for his remarks today, as Special Assistant to the Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs. Dr. Ellsberg is the recipient of countless peace awards. In his presentation today, he will discuss the dangers of global confrontation by the superpowers in his remarks titled, Are We the Last Generation? Dr. Daniel Ellsberg.
Thank you very much. I'm going to try to pack quite a bit of information into a short time here. They assure me that the time will end on time. So as not to waste time in information that is already familiar to you. Am I, is this echo here, but too much, too close to it? Won't be quite close to it. Can you hear me all right?
I'd like to have them work with it here.
Thanks. How's this? Better? Okay, thank you. Forgive me if I start by getting a little information from you fast so that I will not be covering material that is really unnecessary to go into in detail. A very short quiz, two questions. In his best-selling memoirs, reprinted in various magazines and now best-selling paperback, H.R. Haldeman, Chief of Staff to President Nixon, alleged or asserted that President Nixon did have a secret plan to win the war when he came into office in 1969, and that he carried that plan out, although to his regret, it was unsuccessful. I want to ask how many people in this clearly very well-informed audience believe that you know what that plan was, that is, what Haldeman says that it was? Please don't be modest, because if you do know, I don't want to have to waste the time. I don't see any hands, actually. One other question. This may give you a hint. He said that Nixon's secret plan was to end the war, actually to win the war, in the same way that his former boss, President Eisenhower, from whom he learned the approach, had used to end the Korean War successfully, that is, on an acceptable negotiated basis. What strategy of President Eisenhower's is he referring to? How many people here believe you know the answer to that? I see two hands out of about 200 people. Could you tell me what the answer is? Nuclear weapons, correct. Not a nuclear reactor, of course, nuclear energy. Specific form of nuclear energy, nuclear weapons, is the answer this gentleman has given. If that were correct, it would seem a part of our history worth knowing, would it not? It is correct, And I don't mean to embarrass this audience or in any way be invidious with respect to other audiences by asking you to reflect on the fact that you didn't know it. Let me, I could summarize this fast, but I think I will quote a little directly from Haldeman's Ends of Power, page 82 and 83. Nixon saw his advantage in that fact that the communists regarded him as an uncompromising enemy. Quote, they'll believe any threat of force that Nixon makes because it's Nixon, he said. Quote, he saw a parallel in the action President Eisenhower had taken to end another war. When Eisenhower arrived in the White House, the Korean War was stalemated. Eisenhower ended the impasse in a hurry. He secretly got word to the Chinese, that he would drop nuclear bombs on North Korea unless a truce was signed immediately. In a few weeks, the Chinese called for a truce and the Korean War ended. That's a very close paraphrase of the account that President Eisenhower gives in his memoirs. It was indeed secret at the time that I was volunteering for the Marine Corps, in fact, during the Korean emergency. Served 3 years in the Marine Corps. I did not know this particular threat, and you haven't learned it till now, although, interestingly, it has been in the memoirs. It has not been impressed on your mind, let's say, by later presidents. At least one of them, though, inevitably was aware. It is correct to say not only that Nixon knew that threat had been made when he was vice president, it's also come out in memoirs of chiefs of staff and of the famous interview, the brink of war interview with John Foster Dulles, but that Eisenhower believed that that threat had been successful in ending the war. And whether he was correct in believing that or not, the fact that he believed it is of considerable significance for the likelihood that he himself would use such threats and mean them in the future. Eisenhower makes it quite clear, by the way, that the threat was not a bluff and that he was fully prepared to carry it out. Haldeman goes on to say, and I will have to tell this quite shortly, his approach was to, trying to cut this down here, he expected to utilize the same principle of a threat of excessive force. The threat was the key, and Nixon coined a phrase for his theory, which I'm sure will bring smiles of delight to Nixon haters everywhere. He said, I call it the madman theory, Bob. I want the North Vietnamese to believe I've reached the point where I might do anything to stop the war. We'll slip the word to them that, for God's sake, you know Nixon is obsessed about communism. We can't restrain him when he's angry and he has his hand on the nuclear button. And Ho Chi Minh himself will be in Paris in 2 days begging for peace. As Haldeman points out, it didn't work that way, although the threats were delivered. I have confirmed from people who worked, and I'm happy to go into this further if we have time afterwards. I know that the talk itself here is timed closely for radio, but I will stay behind if anyone wishes to discuss references on this point. Those threats were made. They were not bluffs. I have talked to, for example, Roger Morris and others who have worked on the planning in the fall of 1969 in connection with what Nixon calls in his memoirs his November ultimatum. And I won't ask for hands this time. Well, I'll ask if anybody is aware that he gave an ultimatum of massive escalation in 1969. I'd be interested in seeing a hand, but I don't see any. That too is part of our more recent past, which we might well know, but was kept secret from us at the time and would appear is hidden even now. The threats were delivered, targets were selected. As in the case of Korea, some of these secrets, thanks to the Freedom of Information Act, have been coming out in a little more detail lately. Thanks to Professor Barton Bernstein of Stanford, he recently made available to me a document which he got unclassified through the Freedom of Information Act just last month, last fall. Top secret, formerly top secret document, it's discussion at the 131st meeting of the National Security Council, Wednesday, February 11th, 1953, top secret, 27 years until this fall. And in this is now the first month of Eisenhower's administration, when he was making the threats which he describes making in his memoirs, but in much less detail. Mark Clark, having asked for permission to hit a so-called sanctuary at Kaesong, K-A-E-S-O-N-G, where there was a supply buildup and he was afraid there might be a new offensive, the president stated his desire that the Secretary of State, Eisenhower, begin prompt consideration of this matter of attacking the sanctuaries at Kaesong and breaking the armistice as of that time. With our friends, consideration with our friends and to determine their reaction to this proposal. he, Eisenhower, then expressed the view that we should consider the use of tactical atomic weapons on the Kaesong area, which provided a good target for this type of weapon. In any case, the president added, we could not go on the way we were indefinitely. General Bradley thought it desirable to begin talking with our allies regarding an end of the sanctuary, but thought it unwise to broach the subject yet of possible use of atomic weapons, that is, even secretly with our allies. Secretary Dulles discussed the moral problem and the inhibitions on the use of the A-bomb and Soviet success to date in setting atomic weapons apart from all other weapons as being in a special category. It was his opinion that we should find a way to break down this false distinction. The reason that this document was secret at the time and much later was rather evidently not to keep the possibility of nuclear weapons from our adversaries. As Dulles and Eisenhower have revealed, they were told of this possibility. And since they did not want to appear to be backing down in the face of nuclear threats, they cooperated with us till now in keeping that secret from you. Even though, as I say, the incentives to have memoirs led to it being in the public print by this time. As to why it was so important to keep it a secret until the weapons were used, Eisenhower's comments in his memoirs, this is page 180 and 81 from Mandate for Change, are very enlightening and related to the present circumstances, with one difference we'll see. If we decided, says Eisenhower, upon a major new type of offensive, the present policies would have to be changed and the new ones agreed to by our allies. Foremost would be the proposed use of atomic weapons. And when he says proposed, he'd said on the previous page, it's on the same page. It was clear to me that we would have to use atomic weapons. In this respect, American views, says Eisenhower, have always differed somewhat from those of our allies. For the British, for example, the use of atomic weapons in war at that time would have been a decision of the gravest kind, associated, you'll see, with Bradley's recommendation then that we not prematurely expose this planning to the British. My feeling, said Eisenhower, was then and still remains that it would be impossible for the United States to maintain the military commitments which it now sustains around the world without turning into a garrison state did we not possess atomic weapons and the will to use them when necessary. But an American decision to use them at that time would have created strong disrupting feelings between ourselves and our allies. He does not say our public, but others have made that point. Quote, however, if an all-out offensive, brackets, including these weapons that he's speaking of, should be highly successful, I felt that the rifts so caused could in time be repaired. That thinking then, as I say, clearly was shared by, and the apparent success, as they believed it, was shared by, feeling of success, was shared by Vice President Nixon, which had great implications for the plan he was likely to bring to office. And indeed, had we known this planning in 53, we could have made that inference about President Nixon when he did come to office. As it was, he successfully has kept this secret until quite recently. It is not, however, only those two presidents that have made such preparations for the possible use of nuclear weapons or even threatened them on occasion. Every president from the invention of nuclear weapons has heard serious discussion and proposals in the Oval Office of the President, proposals that are never made in that area lightly or frivolously, proposals to use nuclear weapons imminently in initiative use, a first use initiating nuclear war by the United States, not against Moscow or an all-out strike against the Soviet Union, but quite the contrary, a limited tactical theater use against enemies who, in fact, did not possess nuclear weapons. Obviously, a more safe, a less reckless proposal to use the weapons than it would be to use them against Russian troops directly. Equally obviously, a kind of precedent, had it been fully carried out, that would have led to nuclear wars that did not have that limitation in the future. Very briefly, just to mention some of the other occasions. 1950, Harry Truman mentioned the possibility of using nuclear weapons in December 1950 in connection with Korea, which brought Prime Minister Attlee across the ocean to protest. That's what Eisenhower was referring to here. Whereupon we never again made that threat publicly until this month. a point I'm obviously coming to. 1953 in Korea, you've just heard. 1954, Nixon also confirms Prime Minister Bideau's account that we had offered 3 tactical nuclear weapons for the defense of French troops surrounded at Dien Bien Phu in Indochina when I was on the Marine drill fields in Quantico. 1955, the Tachin Islands, offshore islands dispute with China. 1958, perhaps the most serious occasion in the entire generation, in which Eisenhower made full preparations for the use of nuclear weapons should the communists pursue their shelling of that island 6 miles offshore mainland China, on which Chiang had stationed several hundred thousand of his troops. In fact, in that case, the Zheng chiefs were authorized to do full planning on the assumption that nuclear weapons would be used, although the president reserved the final decision at the last moment to himself. 1961, the Berlin crisis. Also, a Laos crisis, secret. The Berlin crisis was open and involved Europe, the last time that a president openly discussed the possible initiation of nuclear war in response to communist aggression. Recall that that was associated with the fallout shelter program at that time. 1962, of course, the Cuban Missile Crisis. 1968, Marines were surrounded at Khe San. I had just come back from Vietnam at that point. The Joint Chiefs ensured the president, it is now known, and studies that I can give you, that if attack were made in bad weather, very common in that area, where it was not possible to give effective close air support, it would be necessary to consider the use of tactical nuclear weapons in the defense of those surrounded troops in Indochina. A proposal, by the way, which General Westmoreland believed should have been carried out, and in retrospect believes was a great missed opportunity. 1969 to 72, as I've just told you, the threats made by the Nixon administration. I'm referring specifically to the occasion of December 72, when those threats were being made by sources that have become public, but are not generally in the public consciousness at this point. I repeat then, each president has made such threats. It is in that context, in each case, with the exception of the Nixon, of the Truman threat in 1950, and the Berlin crisis involving or Europe 19 years ago, the others secret from the public and involving prudently, relatively prudently, opponents other than the Soviet Union, people who do not have nuclear weapons. Finally, let me, I know you're timing this very closely. How much more time?
1:15.
Fine, thank you. Brings us to the present. On the earlier questions, I must admit that I would have been surprised had many people raised their hands, because I have asked those questions of hundreds of audiences, and that is not an exaggeration. In other words, many, many thousands of people. I have never met an American who knew the answer to the Haldeman question. I seem to be the only person who has read those memoirs, aside from Haldeman, if he's read them. And in fact, I'm sure that Nixon and Haldeman, inevitably as authors, have their heart warmed by understanding that how closely I had read those memoirs. The next question, I would have assumed that you would know, but it's come to my attention that I can't assume that, which raises interesting questions in itself. How many people remember reading the article in the San Francisco Chronicle, Saturday, January 19th, which led to the Stanford rally, which I addressed, and which led, that in turn led to my invitation here? The title is Doomsday Talk in Washington by Jack Nelson of the LA Times, and reprints his article of the previous day in the LA Times, which I had happened to see on the newsstand, and I paid 40 cents for an LA Times that earlier day. Russia versus Iran, US ponders the unthinkable. How many people here remember reading this article? How many do not, can I ask? Actually, well, there's a few who aren't sure whether you remember it or not. But that was a few days before the president's speech and forecast what the meaning would be of the speech the president was about to make. The key sentence in it was that White House officials speaking to the LA Times now, but not with their names attributed, high White House officials, and this was not in no way denied by the White House later, are speaking about the ultimate unthinkable possibility, war with the Soviet Union. Such a war, officials believe, almost certainly would become a nuclear war because the United States has concentrated on its nuclear capability rather than on matching the Soviet Union's massive strength in conventional warfare. If you've been following this closely, the words may ring a bell in terms of Eisenhower's memoirs of 20 years ago, the need for such threats. If they went into Pakistan or Iran in pursuing the kind of aggression, or even worse, which they have just obviously perpetrated in Afghanistan, the U.S., quote, would have little choice but to oppose it militarily. And the theme of these deliberate interviews with the L.A. Times, Jack Nelson, were to put out the understanding of White House officials, allegedly, that that war would have to be nuclear. The president, a few days later, spoke of his commitment of our military forces, his role apparently as commander-in-chief, although curious bypassing of Congress's role in connection with war, declaration of war, and supporting war, that we would oppose such a move with all necessary means, including military force. Those of you who had read the Jack Nelson article should have heard that, I believe, the same way that I heard it from a somewhat different source. I had read the article. I had also been familiar with wargaming going back 20 years, in the late 50s and early 60s, which at the Rand Corporation and in the Pentagon, which had concluded that Russian moves that close to their borders in that particular terrain of either Afghanistan or Iran could be stopped only with the use of such things as atomic demolition munitions, nuclear mines, in effect, or other nuclear means that would stop them. I'd assumed that the terrain not having changed, the logistical aspects of this not having changed, that would be the studies underlying the president's talk. Actually, within days after the president's talk, another study was released, this from the New York Times, and released in the Chronicle, again on Saturday, I see, which may be why people missed it a lot. February 2nd, 1980, Secret Pentagon Study of Russian Supremacy. How many recall the content of this article? I'm sorry that I see only two hands in this audience. It is the most significant and important single leak that I recall ever having seen. It is, of course, of the character of being a secret Defense Department study of current capabilities and possible options in the Persian Gulf, of the character of studies going back 30 years and 20 years and 10 years that I released in the Pentagon Papers some 10 years ago to Senator Fulbright. This one differs only in being not a matter of history, as those were. The latest document in that study was several years old. This is a current top secret study about a current intense crisis, which the president has himself described as the most serious since World War II. A very detailed account, especially in the New York Times version, of the exact options. I mentioned, by the way, though, again, not to complain, I'm glad this study is out. The public does need to know the contents of that study, but I noticed that no one has been indicted for 115 years for releasing this particular top secret study. I'm not complaining, as I say, because I'm glad to have that information and to pass it on, since it seems to need passing on, but I infer from that with certainty that this represents a White House deliberate official revelation, not properly described as a leak in some other sense. The theme then of this article in the Times and in the San Francisco Chronicle is that our ability to carry out the president's current proposal to commit military force to stop Russian moves in the northern Persian Gulf region or anywhere in the Persian Gulf, in the Middle East, that our ability is fatally non-existent, really, in terms of our ability to stop them, nor would the draft change that situation. It would not change the geographical factors or the terrain factors which make that area of the world, although not within Russian borders, comparable in relative ability to operate militarily in it to Czechoslovakia or Hungary, where obviously, despite great and proper desire to halt what the Russians were doing in their invasions of those areas, no administration has chosen to counter them for the reasons of the risks to world peace and to world survival that would be involved. What this study said was the Persian Gulf, though not in Russian borders, has the same character as does Cuba with respect to us, or Canada, or Mexico, where the Russians would have been incapable of confronting us with conventional weapons. And therefore, the study done before the president's speech and in his hands at the time he made that speech said they can be stopped only with tactical nuclear weapons, which the study therefore proposed we base our planning upon. I understand from these announcements that the administration wishes this time the public to know, in contrast to the other occasions I have described, what is the reality of our military planning. And that reality underlying the threats that the president has made with vast approval is a reality in which the public is being told what the Russians already knew. Our only ability to carry out that policy is by threatening or using so-called tactical nuclear weapons. You notice that Secretary Dulles, going back to 53, said it was important to break down the distinction in the public's mind between tactical and conventional warfare. That's not easy to do on the basis of facts. On the basis of facts. Facts rather underline that distinction rather than undermine it. A few years later, it has been revealed on Freedom of Information Act documents, Eisenhower was saying on the relative to nuclear testing of thermonuclear H-bomb weapons in our own country, in Nevada, keep the public confused on this issue. Do not mention the distinction between A and H weapons. Quick, not to answer the question, but just to tell me, how many people here, and many of you are my age and even older, how many of you recall or know the difference in the effects of A and H weapons? I see a handful of hands. Maybe there are more, and people are being modest. I find that young people definitely do not know that. H weapons, thermonuclear weapons, did not exist as operational weapons when Dulles made that point about keeping the public in the dark, or rather breaking down the distinction in 53. They did exist in 58 for the Quemoy crisis, and they do exist both with us and the Russians in 69 when Nixon made his threats, and today when Carter is making his threats. We have 30,000 nuclear warheads. They are essentially all thermonuclear warheads now, not H weapons, and then small and large, not A weapons. And since you are not quite familiar with that distinction, I wish to make it, because the distinction between the thermonuclear age in which we now live and the atomic age of Hiroshima and Nagasaki is as great a factor as the difference between the conventional war of the past and tactical nuclear war, or atomic war, the atomic war of Hiroshima. I have only a minute left to make this point. When I studied command and control of nuclear weapons in the Pentagon, the possibility of accidents, I was aware then of a classified report, since unclassified but not well known, in which one of our B-52s dropped its standard weapon, a 24 megaton thermonuclear H-bomb. A thermonuclear weapon has an A-bomb for a trigger, a Nagasaki-type weapon for a trigger. We are still making 3 to 10 a day of those at Rocky Flats in Colorado. The A-bomb, the Nagasaki bomb, had a power of 20,000 tons of TNT. In all of World War II, we dropped 2 million tons of TNT. Without using A-bombs, in Vietnam, we dropped nearly 4 times that, 7.5 million tons of TNT, 4 World War IIs almost. The bomb dropped by mistake near Goldsboro, North Carolina, when a B-52 crashed, was 24 million tons. That's 1,000 times the Nagasaki bomb. It is 3 Vietnams in one bomb. 12 World War IIs in one bomb. Like nuclear reactors, of course, it had safety devices on it, 6 in all, that would keep it independently from exploding on the people of North Carolina if it were dropped accidentally, as it was, and as many others have done. Only 5 of the 6 failed in the course of the fall and hitting the ground. So one did keep it from an explosion that would have released more explosive power than all the wars of human history, including Vietnam. That is not a distinction that can be erased on the basis of facts in the public mind, as the various administrations have understood, and therefore they have really not sought to do it, instead keeping the public simply unalert and unaware of what we mean when we talk of nuking the Ayatollah, as the popular slogan has it, and as Nixon has it, talking not of the Ayatollah but of the region. He is proposing today to wire, in effect, the Persian Gulf, perhaps with U.S. bases, U.S. troops, eventually with draftees, but as a tripwire to assure the Russians, as Secretary Brown has pointed out, that, and I have other quotes to that effect from administration officials, that should they commit further aggression of the kind they have just committed, and of this kind history has seen so much of, and probably will and again, we have wired the Middle East as effectively to blow it up as an area, a region, as the refugee, as the students in Tehran have wired the embassy. But it is not only the people of the Middle East who are thus hostages to that strategy, as are our people in the embassy. To make first use threats of nuclear weapons, as the president is explicitly doing in 1980, in an area and a world so loaded with nuclear weapons on both sides, is to play Russian roulette with a gun that is pointed to the heads of all our children, Russian, American, and all the children of the future. There are more than one finger on that trigger. In fact, we see in the paper today that that CBS News reported that it confirmed last night that Israel had conducted a test in South Africa a few years ago. More fingers are to come. What is new in the situation is not that the threats are being made. The Russians did not need to know that that was our policy and that that is what the meaning of those carriers in the Indian Ocean is. Those carriers filled with nuclear weapons. The Russians know that and have always known it, which is what makes the likelihood of this particular threat being called close to non-existent. What is new in the situation is that the president has chosen to let us in on the secret. I find that both sinister for the future and a challenge. And activities I've been in recently, including being here today, are my part in meeting that challenge. I believe that draft registration, which clearly has no relevance whatever to the crisis being defined for us in the Middle East, against our vital interests, as admitted by the administration, does have the meaning of attempting to mobilize not merely 19 and 20-year-olds, but their parents and all of us, in support for a presidential military policy which centrally and this time publicly is based upon the threat to initiate tactical nuclear war. If we are silent, or approving openly of that policy, those threats will be made more often than the dozen or so times I have just described, and with more ambitious objectives, in a world where they have become far more dangerous than they ever were in the past, a world which is indeed one of parity with the Soviet Union and which many other people are about to get nuclear weapons. I conclude that it is now essential, and perhaps with this challenge before us, possible for the American people to tell Congress and the administration, those who agree with me, that no American president should threaten, prepare, or carry out the initiation of tactical nuclear war or strategic nuclear war as an initiative under any circumstances whatever. And to say that that applies to the Persian Gulf is indeed to say that it applies to situations where we do have strong, significant interests, whether they are as vital as the president says or not. Any circumstances whatever, with an eye to our responsibility toward future generations of life on this earth. I will be doing what I can to alert people, and as you can tell from the answers today, some work is necessary, to the risk that lies before us right now and urging them to join with many others in opposing it. Thank you very much.
Be careful, let's get behind you.
President John R. Schuman will preside over the question and answer period.
Thank you, Ellen Newman. Dr. Ellsberg, if you'll return to the podium, we have many questions, which we'd love you to perhaps cover briefly so we can get through a number of them. Do you believe that Russia has imperialistic ambitions?
Yes.
Doesn't lack of conventional military preparedness increase the probability of a nuclear response by the U.S. if our vital interests are threatened?
I'm sorry, would you repeat that?
Doesn't lack of conventional military preparedness on our part increase the probability we will have to resort to the nuclear alternative?
I would like to I believe I'm in sympathy with the person who asked that question, but let me rephrase it a little bit. I want to resist the habit of mind and expression which many of us Americans have been led to make quite casually, to say that there are circumstances in which we have to initiate nuclear war, or might have to, or contemplate. That's a widely believed thought to which the president is obviously appealing. I would like to break down that as a habit of mind. I'm sure there are many people in this room alone, let in the rest of the country, who would approve the president's policy that I have described as a choice, and it is a decision. But I wish to resist the notion that there are circumstances in which somebody else has to initiate nuclear war, as opposed to choosing it. In terms, however, of whether lacks in our conventional capabilities could encourage those who believe in initiating nuclear war to make that proposal with some basis in reality, in what I would say are very short-term calculations, I would say yes, and therefore, for example, rather than spending money on the neutron bomb, which is for first use only, and is meant to be a substitute, and I can go into the point, but a very bad substitute, for otherwise available non-nuclear anti-tank weapons, I would be very much in favor of building up the stockpiles in Europe and elsewhere in the world of the modern non-nuclear anti-tank weapons, this is an example, of course, of capabilities, which are currently available and require only money, a fraction of the money now being spent on nuclear weapons, to make the Russian tank and all other tanks in the world essentially obsolete as the battleship. I think that would serve world peace and be thoroughly desirable. Other examples could be given.
What percentage of the U.S. population would survive an all-out nuclear exchange with Russia?
No one knows. Edward Teller frequently says, and others at Lawrence Livermore Lab, that an all-out exchange would absolutely not kill all life on Earth. And I know the studies to which they're referring, and one could say they are probably right. No such statement can be made with any high degree of assurance in terms of such a massive exchange involving a large fraction of the 30,000 weapons we have and of the 20,000 weapons they have. The ecological uncertainties of that, the effects on the ozone layer and elsewise, present the possibility that all life on Earth would die in the long run. But that is not a probability. The calculations made known to me when I was in the Pentagon, in fact, when I drafted a question of the Joint Chiefs of Staff for President Kennedy, which he gave to the Joint Chiefs of Staff in 1961. The question was, how many people would die in Russia and China alone if we carried out our war plans, which were essentially only first strike plans at that point early in the Kennedy administration, having inherited them from Eisenhower. The Joint Chiefs' calculation, probably correct, was that 325 million people would die by American bombs on Russia and China alone, ignoring the fallout, which they also had calculations of, which would virtually annihilate the neighboring countries of Finland, Austria, Japan, Korea, and Afghanistan. This is in 1961. From our strikes alone, not counting the Russian retaliation on us, not counting the Allied retaliation. Herb York, in his book, has said that, and he was familiar with this much longer than I, that this figure of several hundred million deaths, not casualties, deaths, remained constant as warheads tended to get smaller than the one I described, but more numerous as they got put on missiles. Probably about the same today. Probably then the figure is about half a billion people within 6 months, ignoring the possibilities then of much larger long-run damage. That is what is being invoked as a possibility in our name by our president, following in the footsteps of all of his predecessors since this bomb was invented. I think his predecessors were well advised to keep their threats secret from the public. I hope that is true. It is clear that the president did not choose to test whether others would regard us as having interests so vital as to compel us or permit us to take actions leading to the deaths of half a billion people. We are now being challenged to join the president in such threats. I hope we will not do that.
Are you opposed to the United States having nuclear capability, or only opposed to our using it as a threat?
That's a good question. I do not agree with some of my colleagues who believe that given the figures I've described, which pose the possibility of a U.S., and of course, or of a Russian, but a U.S.-initiated Holocaust on the scale of 100 from the Nazi Holocausts, 500 million, 600 million, that in the words of Pope Paul, it is not only immoral and evil under all circumstances to use such weapons, but Pope Paul said to possess such weapons. And from them, colleagues of mine feel that's not because they hear it from the Pope, but because that's right, that one must simply divest oneself of such a inherently genocidal threat. I find that very difficult, and in fact, I cannot follow them in that. It seems to me that for us to make ourselves, I'm sorry, by our own action, to make some other group of nations or single nation a monopolist of nuclear weapons in the world would lead to the effects that it had on us of having a monopoly in the weapons in the period that I've described for you. And that wasn't good for world peace. It wasn't good for my ultimate objective, the eventual abolition of nuclear weapons all around the world, the objective that Jimmy Carter some years ago during his campaign put forward. The group I work with, Mobilization for Survival, the Northern California Alliance for Survival, has as its motto, zero nuclear weapons, which is a straight quote from Jimmy Carter as an approach. The program then that I'm describing is very modest with respect to that. No first use of nuclear weapons under any circumstances. The Russians, by the way, have often proposed that as a bilateral deal. I wish they'd done it unilaterally as they could, but they haven't. We have rejected it unilaterally or bilaterally because of the reliance that successive presidents have made on such threats. Second, an immediate moratorium on the United States, limited moratorium on the production, deployment, or testing of nuclear weapons, since in the light of an objective which would say nuclear weapons have no other function than deterrence, and that is the function that I am associating with them in my own mind. If they have no other function, you don't need 30,000 and you don't need Trident cruise missile neutron bombs for that function. And no one in the Pentagon will really argue with you that you do. Those extra weapons are in order to make threats basically against people who don't have nuclear weapons, like the Koreans in the past, the Chinese in the past, the Indochinese in the past, not the Russians. And that's what those weapons are for, basically. Since I don't want us to initiate nuclear war in any circumstances, I would feel that we not only can absolutely safeguard our national security without adding new weapons, we should then propose bilaterally that that moratorium, that freeze, be extended indefinitely. We have never made such a proposal, so whether the Russians will accept it in good faith, they have made it, by the way, but whether they would accept it in good faith should be tested, in my opinion, by our making that proposal and entering negotiations. We have not proposed a total freeze on all these new developments. And in the context of such a total freeze, then to move for large-scale reductions on both sides, bilateral, that is the approach, I believe, to a more secure world. And if the Russians don't agree, I have no doubt at all, zero in my mind, that we will resume any amount of building, whatever I were to say or anyone else, whether I thought it was a good idea, and that's what the Russians would assume, which gives them a good deal of incentive for joining us both in the freeze and in going down. I think that could happen. What cannot happen, I would say, is for us to continue going up as we have insisted on doing, outside the framework of SALT negotiations, cruise, Trident, MX, without the Russians following us up. I think then we have a choice between certainly a two-sided move upwards or possibly a two-sided move downwards. I don't believe, finally, in light of that question, I don't believe in the possibility, or perhaps ultimately even the desirability, of a one-sided move downward by this country. I don't think that's possible or desirable.
Wouldn't a system of universal military service with no exemptions be more democratic than our present volunteer army?
No, because, in my opinion, because it would give the president the power to use the almost indefinitely expandable armed forces as a presidential guard in the fashion of so many presidents in our past, starting with Harry Truman in Korea. In other words, successively, under the pressure of various crises and Russian provocations of the real kind we have just seen, the president will get advance black checks from Congress, as happened before Vietnam, which he will then proceed to cash without having to go back again to Congress. In that sense, I think that what the President is asking for is very like the Tonkin Gulf Resolution drafted in the Pentagon, in the White House, for Congress, while I was in the Pentagon, which Congress signed as a blank check, almost the words of Carter's words, to use any means necessary, including military force in the Far East, and which freed the President ever from going back, either for a declaration of war — he treated that as a declaration of war — or he didn't have to ask for a draft at that point. And because of that, he was able to put 500,000 troops in Vietnam before he reached the necessity to mobilize reserves. Without the draft, Vietnam could not have happened. That puts a very, very heavy burden, I would say, on anyone who proposes such a blank check in the future.
Did Senator Fulbright encourage you to obtain and provide him with the Pentagon Papers?
I copied the Pentagon Papers, which were in my sole authorized possession at the RAND Corporation. I was the only man in the government that is working for the government doing studies of Vietnam with access to those papers. I believe that I should not have sole access to them as a member of the executive, but that Senator Fulbright, in particular, of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, should share that. I believed that he would have no capability of getting that incriminating document of lies and aggression, 23 years of it, from the Defense Department, despite the fact, of course, that he is authorized to receive secret documents from them and has congressional responsibilities. I described the study to him, asked him if he wanted it. He said, "Indeed, I do." I handed it to him with his great thanks. It did not lead to studies. It did not lead to hearings for a number of reasons we could go to, which is why I eventually, two invasions later, gave it to the New York Times at what was recognized to be a still higher degree of risk to myself. Senator Fulbright had encouraged me to do that. He thought that was a better route than the possibility of hearings at that point. He did, in fact, ask four times of Secretary Laird of the Defense Department officially in writing for the study, which he described, to be delivered to him in his capacity as chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee. And with no reason given, but as I had expected, Secretary Laird each time refused to give him the study. I was correct, in other words, in believing that the only way that Congress would get that study was for someone to have who had it to copy it and give it. And I did not decide that I could wait for Secretary McNamara or Katzenbach or some of the others who had it to be the one to do that.
We have time but for one more question. After it has been asked and answered, this meeting will be adjourned. Before asking it, I'd like to thank you, Dr. Daniel Ellsberg, for your very interesting remarks on the subject, "Are We the Last Generation?", given here before a large crowd in the Ralston Room of the Sheraton Palace Hotel in San Francisco. Your remarks will be read by our 14,000 members in our weekly publication, The Commonwealth, and will be heard over the 121 radio stations which broadcast club events. Your final question is, are there any presidential contenders whose views you admire? If so, which ones and what views?
You will have noticed a certain preoccupation on my part with a particular policy issue which goes back to the time when I was 14, when Hiroshima occurred, which led me to join the RAND Corporation in order — I spent 9 years in all in the RAND Corporation — in order to do what I could then from the inside to assure that nuclear weapons would never go off in this world, and we would never enter an era where nuclear weapons actually exploded. That preoccupation has continued for this following 20 years. On that light, then, I'm sorry to say that no presidential candidate, to my knowledge, has yet been asked the question directly: do you endorse the explicit threats made by the White House, or to rephrase it, the implicit threats made by President Nixon to initiate tactical nuclear warfare under certain circumstances, or do you oppose such initiation in the present circumstances or others? I would hope that people here and elsewhere, when the candidates come to California, will have the chance to ask that question of the candidates and urge them for the first time in any American presidential election to take a position in front of the American public with respect to that question. And I would hope that would be asked of President Carter directly, too. I believe that the American people will repudiate that position once it is stated, And once we have a chance to choose between candidates on that basis, which we don't have yet, and I don't have yet, what encourages me is not only the belief of those presidents that they could not afford to make the threat secret in the past, but the fact that kept President Nixon from using, from carrying out his plans in 1969 and his ultimatum, which he describes in his book, in his memoirs. He gives one reason and one reason only why he did not carry out an ultimatum which he says was absolutely serious and he was prepared to carry out and which his opponents did not meet. And that was the moratorium of 1969, October 15th, when a million people across the country peacefully walked in the streets against escalation and continuation of that war, and the moratorium and new mobilization in November 15th, 1969. There may be people in this audience who walked in one of those. Some of the younger members may have done it, I often find, when they were 9 or 10. They didn't know because what they were preventing was secret. They didn't know whether they had any effect and tended to believe they had had no effect. The implication of Haldeman's and Nixon's revelations is that the people who did that walking on the streets in 1969 prolonged the moratorium on the combat use of nuclear weapons by another 10 years and gave our species 10 more years to try to solve the problems posed by nuclear weapons. We have not used that time well. Nuclear weapons have doubled on both sides since that time. We must do better in the future or there will be no future generation. But I know from the example in Vietnam, we do have a chance. It is possible for the people of this country to change the minds of their most powerful leaders in this country. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Lindsay.